every deal's a little different when you're looking at it. You know, the first thing I'm probably glancing at is total number of technicians, you know, and the size of market. If you have a good core of technicians, you can build around that. You know, it's so much of our service gross and service business is driven by our used car department. Our used car department is our best customer, and that used car department should pay the same price that any other customer coming in the store would be.
You're listening to Driving Performance, your go-to podcast for unmatched expertise in the world of buying and selling an automotive dealership. Each episode features discussions with industry leaders and is brought to you by Performance Brokerage Services, North America's premier family-owned automotive dealership brokerage firm with over 30 years of experience. We're here to ensure you gain the most reliable insights to confidently navigate a transaction and accomplish your unique goals. Whether you're looking to buy or sell, we prioritize building lasting relationships and maximizing the value beyond the transaction level. Here are your hosts, Jamie Farley and Paul Keckney, for another segment of Shifting Gears.
Today, we are thrilled to be talking with Greg Young, owner and president of Greg Young Automotive Group. Greg started his journey back in 1989 selling used cars at a Chevrolet dealership and has worked his way to owning 12 dealerships throughout Nebraska, Iowa, and Wisconsin. We are also happy to welcome Greg's CFO, Alex Morton. Alex is a CPA, joining Greg when they had just two dealerships, and they've been working closely together ever since.
I've had the opportunity to work with both Greg and Alex and get to know them fairly well over a number of transactions. And we're really excited to dive in and get to know you two a little bit more via this podcast.
Sounds great. Appreciate the opportunity.
Well, Greg and Alex, we are so happy to have you on with us today. Greg, before we dive into learning more about your vision and running your retail automotive platform, tell us about how you got started in the industry and what were some of the pivotal moments that led you to buying your first dealership?
Well, so I was going to get in the real estate business originally. My dad was in the real estate business and I was going to school. I was working three jobs, going to school full time. And I went to my dad and said, hey, I can't do this anymore. I can't work three jobs and go to school full time. And I had a baby and I was raising a 1 year old who's now our used car director and vice president. And so I went to him and I said, hey, I want to get in the real estate business. You know, you've done well. And I took all the classes. I'm going to take my real estate exam. And he goes, I don't know. He goes, real estate business isn't all it used to be. And you're going to want to be a broker. The agents are making all the money. And long story short, he said, you're 22 years old. You really don't have any sales experience. Why don't you go get some sales experience? You don't have any buddies that are going to buy a home right now. So go get some sales experience. Look around our neighborhood. We got all these car dealers in our neighborhood. I think they do okay. I think you ought to go visit with them. So I went and visited with one of the neighbors and went and sold used cars for a while. I was not the best used car salesperson in the world, so didn't have the most amazing training on the used car side of things. But two of the managers on the new car side saw some potential in me and they coached me up, and I went over to new cars and they listened to me, coached me along the way, and got to be salesperson of the month. I think the second month I was over in new, and kind of did well over there. And we had two F&I people blow out at the same time. And I had all these finance classes. So I thought, well, I should be in finance. So I went and interviewed for the finance position and ended up getting one of those. So I was 3 months in used, 3 months in new, and then in F&I for a lifetime, basically. Had the opportunity to work different spots at that dealership, worked there for 7 years, and took a toll on the family. It was 80 hours a week, no real day off other than Sunday. And so I had two young kids and took a toll on the marriage. And so I said, all right, I'm going to go look outside the car business and see if there's something else I can't find. Well, car business kind of gets in your blood and you get used to making a certain dollar amount. And there wasn't really anything out there that was going to fit that bill. So I ended up going across town to another Chevy store to be their GSM. I interviewed with the owner and one of the owners, and he said, gosh, I'd love to have you join the team. you know, you don't need to work 80 hours a week for us. And I said, well, he says, you can work 40. I said, well, I can't work 40 and do what you need me to do. I ended up going to work for him. We worked, I probably worked 50, 60 hours a week, but it was fun because it was a store that was doing 80 units a month and we got it to 250 in our heyday. So we turned that deal around. And then along the way, there was another dealer that happened to live in our area and he kind of would pick my dad's brain every once in a while when they were playing cards. And he said, so how's Greg like it over there? And he said, well, he really likes it a lot. He's having a great time and they're doing good things. He goes, yeah, I kind of watch the numbers. They're moving it pretty good. He goes, but he's keeping his ear to the ground because he wants to own the store. And so he reached out about 2.5, 3 years in and he says, hey, I might have an opportunity. I would like to visit with you. And so we went over and visited with him and he had an opportunity in central Nebraska. A guy that he helped get started in the business was having some health issues. And so I said, listen, I really appreciate it, John, but I'm not moving to central Nebraska. I'm an Omaha guy. I'm staying here. And so then he reached out about 6 months later. He had a Chevy store in Omaha and he had offered it to the three sons and the three sons decided to pass. And so I ended up buying it from him. And that was early 2000. We actually shook hands in late 99 and took a little while. We needed to take a little time. We got the deal put together and closed in August of 2000. It was quick once we got it to the manufacturer. But we then moved that dealership in 2006 out west where the growth was. We were in North Omaha and there really wasn't any growth over there. We were really a destination point at that point. And so we moved out there in January of 06. It was a tough time to move. So we basically leaped over another Chevy store. So we lost a lot of our fixed operations and 07, 08 hit, and we all know what happened then. And so nobody knew what was going to happen with General Motors and Chevrolet. So anyway, we fought through that, got through it, and then proceeded to purchase another vehicle or another dealership in 2014. And then I think Paul and I finally crossed paths in about 15 or 16. And the funny part was there was another deal in Iowa that I was looking at and we said, all right, let's get this deal put together. We get it all put together. Well, lo and behold, the seller and the next owner had made a deal between them, left Paul out of it. So Paul and I thought we had a deal. Meantime, these guys already made a deal. So I was a little upset over that, but I got over it. And so Paul was very diligent in trying to make up for that, found another opportunity for us. And we've been working together ever since. It's been a great relationship. It's fun to work with a guy that is fun and that kind of understands who I am. And yep, he definitely gets that.
Back at you, my friend, back at you. Alex, your journey to get with Greg, I know that obviously Alex Young, Greg's son, and you are quite close. And can you just tell us your journey on how you joined Greg?
Yeah, absolutely. Happy to share. Mine is probably a non-traditional one. I never thought about the car business, never even considered it. But I knew Alex Young all the way back to our high school days. Him and I had a lawn business together. So my relationship with Greg really goes back to me probably making his first dealership he just talked about look terrible on the lawn side of things. But we kept in contact and kind of went our separate ways through college. I graduated from Nebraska with an accounting and finance degree and went straight into public accounting. And for 6 years, I had my head down. I was on the partner track there. Didn't think anything of it. Wasn't looking for another job. And New Year's Eve of 2015, Greg texted me. And I actually was at a craps table at the casino. And I saw the text come through and I said, I might be on a heater, but let me call you back. And called him later that afternoon and he tried to convince me to come work for him. And he was end of the year, didn't really consider it. So I told him no once and he's not great at hearing that. So he convinced me to have breakfast a couple weeks later and we sat down and, you know, he told me, it's ironic, he told me that he didn't want me to leave for a job that I loved, but he thought he could sell me on a pretty bright future. And he said, you know, I told him the two things I didn't like about the CPA firm were the number of hours a CPA has to work. I was working way too much, like Greg said. And the other one was I had to I was traveling around to really small towns in Iowa and Nebraska. I'd spent a night in bad hotel rooms and stuff like that. And he's like, oh, you don't have to worry about that. We're based here in Omaha, you know, and obviously working in the office, you can work more standard business hours. You won't have to work too many hours. And so I took the leap of faith, joined Greg. And 2 weeks later, I said, hey, my 2 weeks is up. I'm ready to start. Where do I go? He said, I got this small Chevy dealership in Norwalk, Iowa. I want you to drive out there and get your hands dirty and figure out how to get those books all cleaned up. You know, I had kind of had, we can laugh about it now, but it was the best decision I ever made. You know, the rest is history. But yeah, it was a pretty ironic start. A decade later, here we are.
Well, Alex, you're obviously highly valued. What do you think makes you and Greg such a great team?
That's a great question. I'm certainly the more analytical one. And he is a guy, what I've always been impressed with Greg is he's never met somebody or had a conversation where he didn't see opportunity. And I've been a numbered guy and a CPA, I'm probably more conservative in nature. And you know, what I've learned working with him for 8 or 9 years is he sits down, he has lunch, he sees the vision. He's the visionary of our organization without a doubt. You can learn a lot on the business side of things where, you know what, maybe the deal doesn't make sense, especially when we talk to Paul or we're looking at one. You know, a lot of these deals that we've had don't probably make sense right on paper if you just look at the nuts and bolts of it. But the second you kind of figure out, you know, look at the sales opportunities or where you can get it to and grow it from there, all of a sudden it starts to make a lot of sense. And so he's always pushing, you know, I'm the guy trying to keep the balls from dropping too far and keeping all the details together. So we're very much a yin and yang.
And now he's become that visionary. Now we look at a deal and he goes, I don't know, I really like this one. I think this is good. I like it. We do this and this, you know, and he'll crank the numbers and look at the KPIs. You know, this is what we're doing here. And I think so anyway, now it's fun because we're always looking at opportunities.
So that does kind of bring up a question, because when people have said Greg Young, I always talk about how you're a visionary or your team, for sure, your group now. Obviously, you've gone from one store now to 12 rooftops or 12 stores. What do you look at? What are the key factors you look at? And Alex, you just touched on one, and that is kind of do your own pro forma. But what are the things you look at, maybe the three or four key elements you look at when you're looking at an opportunity to go, this is a good fit or no, it's not? Because I certainly do look at you as a visionary.
Well, I'll go back to the first opportunity that I had, the first dealership that I bought. I was at the store in Council Bluffs and then another store in Bellevue. I saw what the numbers were at both of those. I looked at the first acquisition. I looked at the numbers and I didn't even dig. I just knew on that one. So that one, you knew what you were doing here. You knew what you were doing there. Let's transition and do the same thing here, right? So much, I believe, is our culture. And we create a really good culture in a store. And we make sure that we're all doing the same thing for the most part across the board. And the two highlights for our group, I would say, is our F&I performance and our service performance. And we can go in and, you know, I look at a store now and those are the two things I look at first. Okay, what are we doing in F&I and what are we doing in fixed? Because we know we can get those numbers to in a short time. You know, sales, you never know. I mean, you look at a deal and you say, okay, well, I know that we can do more than what they're doing. Sometimes you're wrong. Sometimes you're right. It's never 100%, but at least you have the basics of, hey, we know we can move the needle in F&I. We know we can move the needle in service. And, you know, you put the numbers together based off that and it either makes sense or it doesn't. And sometimes, hey, there's some deals that we put together that we look at now and say, we swing and a miss. I wouldn't call it a mistake, but you have a learning opportunity and you move on and go to the next one. So those are the two big things that I really look at.
So F&I and service, that obviously makes a lot of sense, but it seems like there's also like a gut factor that is mixed in with it too. Can you elaborate a little bit more on that?
Well, I don't know how you measure the gut factor, right?
Right.
It's locale. Where are you at? Does it fit what we're after? Some of these smaller stores that we acquired in Iowa, I'll give a good example. So Ottumwa, Iowa, it was a huge opportunity. There was huge upside. So we knew there was upside in sales. We knew there was upside in F&I service. Across the board, there was upside. Culture is another one. But the biggest opportunity there was it was our first Toyota point. And we were excited about the Toyota point. And we knew that if we got the right guy there, it's going to do great things. And we were spot on there. So, you know, and then Chevrolet is just a natural for us. We've got a lot of Chevy stores. We've now consolidated a lot of our operations. So we've got a team that does all the ordering for our new vehicles. And so to add a Chevy point, you know, the ordering piece is handled, right? They can just add that to their list of stores that they're handling. So there's, you know, there's little things like that. Alex Young, my son, heads up the used car operations and director of used cars. So he's got four buyers that are constantly looking for inventory for us. And so we know that we can get the right model inventory in some of these stores. So it's the gut is, it's 50%. 50%. The numbers usually don't lie. The gut never, you know, maybe it's 60-40 or something like that. But
so, Alex, for you, one of the things that I heard Greg just say, and Jamie touched on it as well, and that is the fixed numbers. As a former car dealer and retail guy, what I find with service is it takes quite a while to actually grow that. When you put together a pro forma business plan and you decide whether you're going to buy the store based on that pro forma business plan and you're looking at service, is it a 3-5-year plan? How do you turn the corner on service?
Gosh, every deal's a little different when you're looking at it. You know, the first thing I'm probably glancing at is total number of technicians, you know, and the size of market. If you have a good core of technicians, you can build around that. It's so much of our service gross and service business is driven by our used car department. So you're always glancing at that internal labor rate. You know, some of the stores are not charging a retail rate. We believe that our used car department is our best customer, and that used car department should pay the same price that any other customer coming in the store would be. So there's some opportunity there because that's not the same belief of everybody. And, you know, if I'm looking at the used car department and they're not performing as strongly in the market as it could be, that's going to drive service growth, all the reconditioning, you know. And then being a part of a group, we have the ability to pull some levers from the group's perspective as moving inventory around, marketing, brand recognition. So depending on where we're looking at a store, you can kind of drive service just by just moving that needle with marketing as well. So certainly opportunity on the fixed side, you know, not just, you know, trying to organically grow total number of customer pay repair orders. You can kind of do it in a number of different ways.
Greg, you talked about culture a few times, so I just want to jump back to that, especially because it plays into whether the opportunity is a right fit for you. How are you evaluating the culture of a potential opportunity when you're going through the acquisition process?
I don't know that you can evaluate. It's really hard to evaluate culture because all you're doing is looking at a piece of paper because you can't go in and visit with anybody ahead of time, right? So we just know that we can get the right culture in place because culture starts at the top and everybody on our team understands who we are, where we're going, and that we're going to take care of the customer every time. And a lot of times you can tell just by reviews that they're not taking care of the customer. When you're looking at an opportunity, they may or may not. You can look at their Google rating or whatever, but we just know that we can get the right culture in place. And you don't know, you get lucky every once in a while when you have the right people that ready, willing, and able to grab that culture and run with it. We've had, I'd say 60-70% of the stores that we've acquired, probably higher, they're screaming for that culture, that organization, everybody pulling on the same end of the rope. So I don't know that you can actually, you can't tell the culture right away. You just got to build it.
Well, no, that helps clarify things that, hey, you're looking at it as an opportunity to go in and really make a difference for the team, the staff, and the community.
Absolutely. We're very community focused and we've done a good job. Almost all the locations establishing that early. I'll use Ottumwa as another example that the previous dealer wasn't that involved with the community. And that was one of the things that we did right away. And our general manager out there has done just a spectacular job of reaching the community, embracing the community, and letting them know that we care and that we're going to play a big part in their community, especially these smaller towns. You know, that's car dealers are a big part of it.
Alex, question for you. There's so many times that a deal starts to stall a little bit, a transaction stalls. So you do a letter of intent, let's say, in between there, obviously factory approval, the whole thing slows down depending on the manufacturer. But there is that period of time in between that a transaction can stall or really slow down. What things do you do or have in place that helps keep the process moving for both the buyer and the seller?
It's a good question. I would say a couple of things. My focus, you know, is always I have the relationship with the OEM as we sit and wait for them to kind of twiddle their thumbs a little bit and request additional information. And, you know, it's never top priority for them. They're focused on bigger deals or the next thing. So I just try to, from my seat, I try to continually follow up. It's easy to get busy with other things. I just send a weekly recap or a weekly follow up with each of those factory reps that I'm working with, the network set of things. And then I seem to have the ability to communicate pretty well with the seller. And a lot of times, most of the work is in my hands and not the seller's. And so I'm always constantly trying to update them. And I'll be honest, I'll give Performance a lot of credit too. They continue to try to jump on and jump in and try to ask the questions of what it is. And sometimes you have to get a little creative, like set a closing date and tell the OEM or the banks, like, we're going to close. We are going to close. Let's set it. And if you guys aren't ready, you need to be. Like, we're going to move on without you. And it seems like all of a sudden that kind of lights a fire under either the bank or the OEM to try to say, okay, well, we can hit that deadline. Because they like anything, if you don't have a deadline, nobody pushes as hard as they certainly can.
So for either one of you, I know that you've had a couple of attorneys over the time that I've known you where you've maybe changed attorneys. What involvement and how do you decide what a good attorney is? It's a great question because sellers and buyers both, sometimes if they don't have a good attorney, it can really cause an issue in a deal.
It's interesting. You know, all the attorneys, some will have experience in the industry and some do not. And so we've had a multitude of experiences in that respect. We were with a local guy who, you know, helped me get started. And he was a family friend that had done a bunch of stuff for my dad in the real estate business. And we just kind of outgrew what he was probably either capable or even wanting to handle. He was certainly capable, but he just didn't know all the nuances of the automotive. And so we made a change and they were great, but they were not local for us. And so it presented some difficulties there. And then we pivoted and went to a local attorney and they've done a great job for us. Doesn't matter. They're all expensive, right? But it's interesting to have the attorney for the seller can sometimes be difficult as well. And so there's always a little balancing act there. I'll let Alex weigh in on that too. But
yeah, I think in my perspective, I think it's important to have somebody you trust on the real estate side. You know, it's not just an operation transaction, it's the real estate too. And most of the things that have come up in any of our deals has been something goofy with an environmental study or an easement of some sort. So it's less stuff that I work with day to day. And so I really lean on the attorneys on that side. We're pretty lucky. Ours have realized that we can handle the operational stuff. And so they lean on us to figure out what we're paying for parts and the used cars and what you want to do on the new car stuff. That's really pretty standard. And we can kind of work through all that. It's the real estate side that I got to lean on the attorney. Certainly not an expert.
Looking forward, what's your vision for Greg Young Automotive Group in the next, I don't know, 5 to 10 years?
Yeah, we're going to continue to grow. We're going to continue to grow as fast as we can find the right people. That's the biggest resource point, is making sure you got the right people to run the store. We've had a couple instances where we thought we had the right guy and 100% did not. And that slows things down as far as progress. We know what we need to do and how we need to do it. And then we think that we've got the right guy or gal hired to handle it. And it just doesn't get done or doesn't get done fast enough. And so, again, you got to shuffle the deck and start over. And sometimes that slows things down even more. You know, we're going to continue to grow. We're probably focused on a little bigger markets. We've acquired a lot of the smaller stores and now really kind of, I've told Paul, I said, like, look at some bigger markets now.
And just a follow up to that, is there anything going on in the industry right now? Any trends or shifts that you're seeing that you're particularly either excited about or concerned about?
Well, the EV is a big concern. I think for anyone in the business, it's a big unknown right now. And, you know, you got the government, you got administration change. What's going to happen after that? The manufacturers really went all in on EV, right? And, oh, shoot, this probably isn't our best bet. Let's pull back a little bit. But the problem is you've got all these mandates that the government they've got to meet. And if they don't meet them, then they can't produce the number of ICE vehicles that we're going to need. So it's a balancing act for them, but they also realize that we all got to work together to get that fixed on the government side, the federal side. And as far as other concerns, I mean, COVID obviously was a big boom for everybody in automotive, and now we're resetting, right? It's okay, we're back to normal, but it's not normal. You got interest rates going up and maybe coming down and maybe going back up. We'll just follow that as it goes. But yeah, your carrying costs have increased so much over the last year and a half, and now we're getting inventory. So that's something that we've got to learn to manage. It's also great to see several of the manufacturers that have really done a good job of not forcing the inventory down our throats, so to speak. You've got Stellantis, which is another big concern. We've got several Stellantis stores, and we don't know what they're doing. We'll see what happens there. There's some big challenges ahead with them. There's some really good partners out there, and there's some that got to be concerned about. The Chinese coming into our market is going to be interesting too. Don't know what that's going to bring.
So you've grown across multiple states. Any advice that you would give a dealer that's looking to expand? Any pitfalls or any advice you'd say, hey, watch out for this when you start to expand, let's say 2 hours or more away from home base?
Yeah, you get outside 2 hours and it's tougher to get your team that knows how you want things done to that location. And I mean, you can get them there, obviously, but to have them stay there and work with that team to make sure they're doing exactly what you need is a big challenge. You're teaching remotely and you're monitoring remotely, and you can't see that culture. You can't see the day-to-day process. Is it getting done the way that you think it's getting done, the way you expect it to get it done? You know, you can usually see it in the results, but you definitely want to make sure you got the right person. If you're going outside a 2 hour area, make sure you got the right person going there. Build the bench. That's the key.
So what do you do for team building? Have you got some certain things that you do every month, every week, as far as team building? You've been talking about culture that helps really create that Greg Young automotive culture across all states and stores?
Well, you got to leave that to the general manager, I think. But we do have general managers' quarterly meetings, and we get together. We also have an executive team that we meet weekly over Zoom and go over all of our issues. And I can let Alex kind of run through that a little bit, but we just kicked that off 60 days ago, 90 days ago, something like that. And it's been really good. And we've been a little more focused as an executive group, you know, being able to look at the stores that are not doing well and focusing our energies on those stores and what we got to do to fix those issues we're having.
Yeah, I can piggyback off that. I'm a big believer. I'm really buying into this entrepreneurial operating system, the EOS type system. I got introduced to the book Traction earlier this year, and it really opened my eyes on how to run an organization and trying to do it without micromanaging. And really trying to put your pulse on everything. And as we grew to three states and, you know, 12 different cities and 12 different managers with a different management style, it became tough. So it's a really cool system. You know, I encourage everybody to kind of look into it, that, you know, small business, my wife has a small business and she's buying into it all the way up to large organizations. It allows Greg and myself and the executive committee to kind of meet and discuss, and it creates a really cool platform for a 60-minute meeting. You know, we check in, we have a scorecard, and then we talk and discuss and try to solve the major issues at hand. And then we get out, and it's 60 minutes. It's productive. We even have to rank how productive the meeting was at the end of it. And then we go about our week, and it allowed Greg to not have to follow up on, you know, if we meet on Tuesday morning, he doesn't have to follow up on Wednesday and Thursday and Friday and find out if I did my homework that was assigned. He finds out next Tuesday, and I will say, I did it. My week was busy. Sorry, I had a couple of days of vacation. I didn't get it done, but I'll have it done for next week. And it's, I don't get micromanaged. No, none of our managers do. It's really productive, and you can kind of set quarterly goals, and you're following every week on if we're meeting those goals. And I think you can tell it's already starting to permeate with all of our managers. And now I, you know, as a CFO, I do it with all of my accounting managers. You know, I've introduced it to a couple of GMs, and they're doing it with all of their department heads. And so they're able to allow their parts manager, here are your expectations, here's your three KPIs. Come next week and tell me if you've improved them, if you've gone backwards, and why. And it allows it to go to the next step. And so you're empowering all your managers, and inherently you create a great culture and a great system for managers to be heard. They know they can speak up in a meeting, and at the same time, they're going to be held accountable. While sometimes people don't like to be held accountable, when you are, you know that you're valued, and you know that you have an opportunity to communicate with your direct report. So it's been really powerful for us this last 6 months or so. We're really excited about the future of it.
Where did you discover the EOS?
In looking back, I've kind of realized it's everywhere. The second I've said EOS now, I'm sure you guys will jump on podcast or see something this weekend, or you'll see the book. It's probably sitting on your desk at home already. You don't even realize it. But I was at a 20 group meeting, and we had a best idea session, and another CFO said that they bought into it about a year ago. And, you know, a well-run organization can only get better from it. And it allowed, you know, it establishes a platform for growth, because you're not stuck day to day trying to follow up. You have, you know, we all get, you hear everybody complain about ineffective meetings and you're buried with meetings. Now we have a couple meetings throughout the week, and I know they're going to be productive, and then I can go and get my other stuff done. It's certainly made me more efficient Monday through Friday.
And with our structure, we've got COO over Nebraska and Wisconsin, and then one over Iowa. So it gives them something to really focus on for each location. They're able to dig into each location in those meetings and do the same thing with them, as sit down with them and get them focused on what they need to.
So Greg, one of the things that I hear all the time from buyers, they're so focused on trying to buy a store based on a multiple of earnings and taking, you know, last year's earnings or last few years' earnings and just focus in on that. Again, earlier in the podcast, I call you a visionary. I truly believe that there is more to this, right? As a seller looking to sell, obviously they want to get as much money as they can. They're going probably off into retirement and want to sell for the highest number. But is that all there is just a multiple of earnings, or is there more even for a seller who's considering selling? Is there more to the picture?
I think there's a lot more to the picture. I mean, you know, if I were to be selling right now, I would want to make sure that all 800 employees are going to be taken care of, right? And so I would want to make sure that I've got a buyer that I know is going to do that. And I don't know the best way to do that, but I think if you were to look or call to one of our stores, that they would say positive things about our leadership and the way we do business. And so, you know, if a seller is, you always want to chase the dollar, right? You want the most you can get. That's why we work so hard, is to get as much as we can, whether you're running a store or selling a store. So I think that you don't want to get stuck on earnings, especially the COVID earnings.
Right.
And then as far as a buyer goes, when we looked at some deals, they weren't making any money. we knew that there was opportunity based off what we knew we could get done, right? And so I don't think it's a black and white cookie cutter approach. You can't take a black and white cookie cutter approach to buying or selling, really.
Well, and having done business with you a number of times, I know that one of the things you like to do early on is go meet the seller in person, shake their hand, and in my opinion, in watching that unfold, that certainly is helpful for both parties. If you like who you're potentially going to sell your business to, that certainly is helpful. The other thing that I think you've done a really good job on is confidentiality. And obviously, there's a lot of parties that can get involved, but Alex, how do you protect confidentiality for a seller? And I know it's never perfect, and sometimes when you start talking to vendors, things can leak out. But I will tell you, a seller, that's always a big concern. Who's buying my store? Are they going to treat my employees right? And how do I get to the finish line without the whole community finding out about it?
Yeah, it's a tight rope you walk on that. You just over-communicate to every single OEM and every vendor that this is 100% confidential, and you try to get that approval as quickly as you can so you know you're moving towards a closing date. Because then once you have it, then you can find a great date to go meet employees and actually announce it. But until then, I just tell every seller, like, the only people on our team that know is the executive team that's involved or that was buying into the operation. And I like to tag the seller on my communication with the vendors. So they, you know, if I have to have somebody come in and do a environmental and they have to look at the real estate, I want the seller to kind of dictate those terms. If it's after hours or if it's, they could tell their staff that they're getting the building appraised for something else. They feel like they're in control, because I can send out an appraiser to the building and he walks up and he doesn't know what he's supposed to say or who he's supposed to coordinate with. So I lean heavily on the seller and say, look, you guys communicate with whoever's coming out, or if it's a vendor, I want only the seller or his designated employees. Inevitably, there's in the car business, there's always rumors. So you just pretend like nothing's happening and play dumb until you can actually announce for sure.
Having the seller copied on all those emails or communication, I think that's a great plan.
Yeah, I've never been told they didn't like it. I'm sure they get sick of seeing and hearing from me, or they get tagged on a lot, because it's just it's a big process. And there's so many different people and items involved. So you just have to over-communicate. That's like anything.
Right.
We're wrapping up. I just want to say, Greg and Alex, thank you so much. It was awesome talking with you. I think you provided a lot of great insights and advice to our listeners. If they want to get in touch with you, we're going to direct them to gyautogroup.com, and feel free to reach out to either one of you on LinkedIn.
Sounds great. I appreciate it.
Awesome. Thank you very much.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of Driving Performance. The show notes include links to any resources mentioned in today's show. If you're enjoying our podcast, please subscribe so you never miss an episode and leave us a 5-star review. If you're considering buying or selling an automotive dealership, reach out to us at performancebrokerageservices.com or send an email to info@performancebrokerageservices.com.